listening to the FQXI podcast.
Today, a radical take on quantum mechanics in which time flows backwards.
In order to understand the present moment, you have to consider not only the past, which is what we were always taught, but you also have to consider the future.
As experiments help put to bed the idea that neutrinos travel faster than light, Nobel laureate Frank Wilczek tells us why he never believed they did.
You know, it's the old thing, you should have an open mind, but not so open that your brains fall off.
And superstring theory and opera collide in the theory of everything.
He's Brendan Foster.
And she's Zia Morali. So this is the first ever shiny and new FQXI podcast. We're going to bring you the latest ideas in theoretical physics and cosmology.
That's the plan. And we also want to get you involved in asking questions about physics. You can email us at podcast@fqxi.org or tweet us at FQXI.
First up, does the universe have a pre-written destiny? An unorthodox take on quantum mechanics suggests that to unravel some of its paradoxes, we may have to accept that the future can influence the past, and that fate reaches back in the lab and shapes the outcome of quantum experiments. Zia met with one of the proponents of time-symmetric quantum physics, Jeff Tollickson, at Chapman University in Orange County. He began by explaining why on Earth we should even begin to entertain the idea that time flows backwards.
So this starts really from a question that Einstein posed. You know, even though Einstein was one of the fathers of quantum theory, the most successful theory in our history, he was not very happy with it. Like, you know, sometimes parents are not very happy with their children. He was never very happy with it. And the main reason he was unhappy was because the main change that quantum mechanics brought about from the old classical physics, the Newtonian physics, was that it introduced something called indeterminacy at a fundamental level. And what that meant is that, in some sense, suppose you flip a coin, right? If you flip a coin or you roll a dice, in terms of classical physics, if you understood everything about it, like the exact angle that the dice was sitting in your hands and just the exact velocity of your hand and the way the air interacted with it, you could actually predict with certainty whether it would land as a six or a one or whatever. But quantum mechanics said that nowhere in nature is it known. Nature does not know when it rolls the dice what will be the outcome. It could be anything. And so Einstein used this famous phrase. He said, "I don't believe God plays dice. There must be something wrong with the theory. There must be something else that we just haven't postulated yet as a theory that is there, which will tell us what the real outcome will be to when you roll a dice." But so far, after 100 years of testing the theory, it looks like Einstein was wrong. It looks like, really, you know, God is playing dice.
So what conclusion have you come to in terms of physics today?
Well, we found a solution, and it is extremely fascinating. So that idea is the notion that in order to understand the present moment, you have to consider not only the past, which is what we were always taught, but you also have to consider the future.
But isn't it a little bit strange because you're sort of saying that you can predict what will happen now by sort of assuming that what will happen in the future has happened? It seems a bit circular.
Well, actually, you can't predict what will happen. There really is a playing of dice. I've been working with a great physicist by the name of Yakir Aharonov for my whole career, and he had a completely different perspective on this. He asked the question, why does God play dice? And he found an amazing and beautiful answer. He was able to prove that if you want to have a universe in which you have a situation where the future can actually be relevant to the present, yet preserve cause-effect relations, you know, have causality, have a situation where even though the future is relevant to the present, you can't actually find out about it in advance. You can't, you know, I can't tell you what the stock market's going to do tomorrow by reading this information. The only way you could have such an extraordinary combination of seemingly opposite principles was if you were playing dice. So that's the reason.
So this is something that you can test in the lab?
You can, and it has been tested. We believe that there's a signature, there is a record. The future can be relevant to the present, incredibly. And only if you do a new kind of measurement, a new way of looking at the world. And that's these measurements we call weak measurements, or very gentle measurements. And if you do those, then amazingly, you see, in a sense, the imprint of the future and the present. But even more amazingly, it's done in a way that it doesn't violate causality.
Does mm-hmm. that mean that that in some sense the future is set, that the universe has a destiny?
Well, that would not be something that I can say with certainty from what we know about physics. But it's a possibility. That's a way of a very suggestive alternative that this whole new perspective suggests. That, in a sense, you could say that there may be a kind of destiny. But again, this has not been confirmed experimentally. But it's a quite elegant new theory, new way of thinking about the universe.
That was Zia chatting with Jeff Tollickson. So Zia, the idea is that tests in the lab have shown that actions you carry out later can affect what happened earlier?
Yes, that's right. So there are these very specific tests using these so-called weak measurements with lasers that are carried out in three steps. Turns out that the choices you make in the third step affect results that are measured at an earlier time in the second step. For more details about those time-twisting experiments, visit the FQXI website. There you'll find an article by Julie Raymeyer about Jeff Tollickson's work with cosmologist Paul Davis. Together, they hope to find more evidence for time-symmetric quantum mechanics, but this time looking at the cosmic microwave background. That's the relic radiation of the Big Bang.
You can read that at www.fqxi.org/community. We should add that those laser experiments provide solid results, but it's open to debate whether or not to interpret them as showing that the future influences the past. As so much with quantum mechanics, it's all about interpretation. But speaking of violating causality, I have a joke for you.
Neutrino who?
Neutrino.
Who's there?
Knock, knock.
Sorry. It's such a good joke.
Not bad. Well, those neutrinos, those subatomic particles that mildly rocked the physics world last September when the OPERA experiment in Gran Sasso, Italy, announced that they had clocked them traveling faster than the speed of light, overturning, maybe, Einstein's theory of special relativity and opening the door to time travel.
Yes, you don't sound, you sound very skeptical about that there, Brendan. You were sounding appropriately skeptical. We had to bring up the faster-than-light neutrinos now. Well, we won't have much of an opportunity again because... now they're going back to being called just plain old neutrinos. That's because in March, the Icarus experiment neighbouring the OPERA experiment announced contradictory results, basically saying that according to their experiments, they detected neutrinos travelling at the speed of light.
And that surprised pretty much no one. Also, don't forget that in early March, the OPERA experiment also announced that their original faster-than-light findings could have been due to faulty wiring in the experiment.
That's an embarrassing announcement that you never want to have to make. Anyway, it's fair to say that physicists were almost unanimously skeptical about the OPERA claims from day one, and I wanted to know whether that was really fair. So I asked particle physicist and Nobel laureate Frank Wilczek for his thoughts.
I'm hardly surprised, put it that way. Of course, when I first heard about it, I tried to see if it could be fit into everything else we know. And the basic answer was not very easily, to put it mildly. So that made me very skeptical.
So, you know, you said that you were very skeptical, and I think that's pretty much the reaction of most physicists at the time. But would you say that that's a fair reaction in general. I mean, is that the right attitude to have in terms of the way that science progresses, or should scientists be more open to surprising experimental results? Because, you know, they could lead to new discoveries.
Well, you know, it's the old thing. You should have an open mind, but not so open that your brains fall out. But the, I did it the honor of taking it seriously, which means trying to think of ways that it could be accommodated in the framework of everything else we know. That has two aspects. There's a zeroth aspect also, which is, this is a very difficult measurement. So it's error prone from the get-go. Now, they checked a lot of things, but, you know, if there are 153 things that could go wrong, it's not good enough to get 152 of them right. I just took it the wrong answer. And that's the background. You know, if it had been a much simpler experiment with fewer moving parts and less cutting edge technology, then one would not perhaps be so critical of the experiment itself. But then there's an issue of reconciling it with other closely related experiments. So, nature gets the final word. And in this particular case, nature already said quite a bit, because with minimal interpretation, there are other measurements and experiments that are closely related to the one that the OPERA experiment reported on. In particular, there were observations of neutrinos arriving from the supernova, 1987A, where the neutrinos came right on time. And whereas an effect as big as the OPERA people were reporting would correspond to about a 3 years delay, the magnitude of the discrepancy is so large that it makes you wonder. You know, if they had reported an effect that was a billion times smaller, it would have been much more plausible. But an effect as big as they reported, it was very difficult to reconcile with other experimental results. And there's a question of theory, and here I think is what you're hinting around about, which is, are our theoretical prejudices so strong that we're unwilling to consider things that violate potentially special relativity or, you know, just kind of established ideas? And I would say that the answer is absolutely not. You know, I'm thrilled to consider new ideas that challenge the basic framework. And I did in this case. So I tried to cook up little theories of how you might fit this in. But again, the difficulty was reconciling with everything else we know quantitatively and in detail. So, it didn't fly.
So, you know, given all of those, reasons that you've given for skepticism, were the OPERA team right to announce the results when they did? They must have known the sort of skepticism there would be around it, that it was a controversial thing that they were saying. What more could they have done?
Well, they could have checked for loose cables. you know, that's pretty bad. But if they really had carefully checked every aspect of the experiment, and still had a discrepancy, of course, it's legitimate to present it to the world. That would, that's fine. You do have to eventually report the results of experiments, even if you don't have a sensible interpretation of that. I don't know how it happened and who's responsible, whether it was the OPERA people or some over enthusiastic reporters. Some people who, publicity hounds, whatever. I think it got out of hand, though.
Now, you know, you mentioned that of course, you are open-minded about, experimental results that could come in, shocking results that could make you kind of rethink your view of physics. So, you know, is part of you sad that, you know, it hasn't worked out that way in this case?
Well, maybe some tiny part of my lizard brain is sad about it, but there's kind of, how should I say, physics and our view of the world, our understanding of nature has been building for centuries now, and it's gotten more beautiful and more tight in the sense of predictive power. So I'm very open to new discoveries that look like stepping stones to still more beautiful, more unified, more coherent understanding of the world. But, you know, just bizarre, nonsensical results, they don't, that make the world ugly again. Well, you know, if nature works that way, like she gets the final word, but I hope that doesn't happen.
That was MIT's Frank Wilczek scoffing at the thought of faster-than-light neutrinos. Now, from the opera Neutrino Experiment to... an actual opera about physics.
Yes, it's very clever.
Well, thank you. It was a good link. I tried my best there. That's all I can say. That was a clip from Encompass New Opera Theatre's The Theory of Everything, in which a Brazilian quantum physicist contemplates life, the universe, and ancient Native American conceptions of cosmology. Encompass has a good habit of making physics-themed operas. As well as theory, they're currently developing The Astronaut's Tale, and they previewed excerpts from that new opera on March 18th at the Manhattan School of Music.
We sent string theorist Matt Roberts to review The Astronaut's Tale, and we'll hear his thoughts later in the show. But first, Encompass's artistic director Nancy Rhodes chatted to Zia about both those projects and what inspired her interest in physics.
Specifically, in 1987, I read an article in the New York Times Magazine about superstring theory and about the work of Edward Witten. And I was absolutely captivated by the concepts, by the ideas of a multidimensional universe, the interconnections of all life, etc. And so, I began to read everything that I could possibly find on the subject, which at that time, surprisingly enough, there were not a lot of books out. But I did then locate three physicists who I interviewed, one of them being Edward Witten. I also interviewed Brian Greene and later on Michio Kaku.
What sort of advice did they give you? Did they tell you anything specifically about opera, or were they just talking very much in terms of the actual theories?
I would say that Michio Kaku was he thought outside the box. He talked about time travel and all sorts of possibilities that could emerge from these theories. Brian Greene was himself at that time working with some aspects of music and physics, and so he had a kind of immediate interest and rapport, but he gave a very clear picture, and especially later on encouraged the idea, because I became very interested in the holographic principle. And he told me that the holographic principle was one of the leading areas of research in physics today. And I then later on heard five physicists speak on that topic, including Gerard de Hooft, the Nobel Dutch physicist. And Edward Witten was a man of few words, but I will always remember, as I was preparing to leave his office, he said, "Well, now remember, it's all a theory." And in a way, that was very liberating for me, because not being a scientist myself, that kind of liberated me to take my understandings and put them into a form of music.
Your class syllabus reads like a fairy tale. David Bones, anagram, implicate, explicate, order, indigenous views of cosmology, entering the dream time, fringe ideas, unproven science, full of inconsistencies and fantasy. What has this got to do with Physics 101, may I ask?
But of course you're bringing in this whole extra discipline, this kind of historical idea of thinking about indigenous cosmology in a way that perhaps many physicists don't think about, actually. Why did you want to bring those elements in?
I attended some seminars that grew out of the work of David Bohm, a Native American professor who taught Native American studies at Harvard, came upon the writings of David Bohm, the physicist who was teaching actually in Birkbeck College in England for many years and was from this country. And he saw direct connections with David Bohm's writings with the cosmology of Native Americans. It's an extraordinary exchange when you come into direct contact with the ancient understandings of indigenous peoples who grew up with the organic inner connection of the multidimensional inner connected threads of all aspects of existence. So for them, it's a natural, organic whole, and perhaps no other way to understand our existence in the universe.
Now, I have to admit, I don't know very much about how to write an opera. So could you sort of explain, how do you set about when you have an idea for, you know, a certain dramatic moment or a big idea in physics? How do you translate that to a sound?
Yes, that's a very, very good question. I should say that the composer for this, John David Ernest, has said many times publicly he has never been called upon to set a physics lesson, and it was quite a challenge for him. But in fact, it's one of the highlights of the opera.
We've chatted about the physics of it, but how did the general sort of the general opera going public respond to this piece?
Young people are interested I found that young people are really exploring these topics because they want to know, what is existence all about? What is the nature of reality? What where are we going in our planet?
What is the nature of reality? This is the key question to ask. In my own quest to understand the universe.
Now let me ask you about another work that you have in development. This is The Astronaut's Tale, and it's another opera that's going to be dealing with science. Now, as I understand it, this is an opera about a young man who wants to be an astronaut, and he encounters a mysterious Einstein-like figure that sort of leads into a meditation on the nature of the cosmos and the confrontation between science and religion. So, you know, what inspired you to come back to some of these themes about the cosmos and about science again?
I was drawn to this piece because it seriously examines the interface, I would say, between science and religion. The young man, the astronaut, in this piece, grew up in the Midwest of the United States and came from a more fundamentalist religion where he took the Bible as being literal. And so the piece examines his growth in change and ability to look outside of a literal understanding of biblical ideas and find a way to merge them with science. So at one point, there is a lesson between the so-called mysterious Einstein character and the young astronaut. And they are talking, the young astronaut is giving the biblical, let's see if I can find it here. He says, in the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. And the old man, the Einstein character, says, there was no darkness, no depth, no space, only a finite universe, 1 trillionth the size of a proton. Then bang, an immediate inflation, a universe the size of a small ball. Now there is space in a cosmos expanding from not anything to all. And they go back and forth with the young man giving the biblical version and the scientist giving the science version until eventually the young man becomes so excited about the prospect of studying the galaxy and the stars that he announces that he wishes to become an astronaut. I read last night your wonderful article, The Priest Physicist Who Would Marry Science to Religion.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you.
And I was very struck by the quote, the best place to seek scientific support for God is in quantum mechanics, the physical laws describing the subatomic realm. And I would say that that's what The Astronaut's Tale is about. That in fact, the biblical poetry and beauty of the description, the cosmology that's described, is a poetic and quite rich and quite beautiful description, whereas the scientist is illuminating the way that this cosmology came into being very specifically. And so for me, they really interface. I don't see one against the other, but that they merge in quite a magnificent way to describe the beauty, the awe, the wonder of the universe that we are in and that we are made of.
I can sort of imagine this running just as a straight play with words and no music. So what does, you know, bringing the music into it and making this into an opera, what does that add to it? How can you use the music to, I guess, bring in these themes of confrontation and then hopefully reconciliation, I guess?
Well, that's a very good question. And in fact, the way Jack Larson constructed The Astronaut's Tale, there is a narrator, which is an actor, that's a spoken character. And the lesson between the cosmological lesson is actually intoned. It's almost like a kind of Gregorian chant that is part of the piece. And then the music is for Charles Fussell constructed it for 7 musicians. So he has marimba, vibraphone, violin, cello, piano, and a large percussion complement. There's also French horn and piccolo and flute. And so the palette, the musical palette, evokes the galaxies, the stars, the glittering wonder, and the percussion evokes a certain earthbound, earth deep, connection with Mother Earth, with the inner core of the universe. So it it brings another dimension, I guess you would say, to the ideas, the philosophical ideas in the piece.
Thank you to Nancy Rhodes and to Encompass for allowing us to use those clips from The Theory of Everything.
I should also add that I didn't prompt her to bring up one of my articles, but if you're interested in the piece that Nancy mentioned, that was a profile of particle physicist and priest John Polkinghorne in Discover magazine, and we'll put a link to that on the website as well.
Back to the opera. We sent NYU physicist Matt Roberts to watch the Astronaut's Tale performance, and this is what he thought.
I guess that depends very strongly on the taste. It was musically a very modern piece. Scientifically, I would say, yes, it's probably, I would suggest that they should see it, if only to support it, because especially in, things like pop culture and art, there's a lot of, pseudoscience-y mumbo-jumbo when people talk about, what does quantum mechanics really mean? And, what does science say about the soul? And it touched on that in very, I think, in language that was respectful and appropriate both to, people with deeply held religious beliefs and scientists. It was not offensive to me because they got the science right, but it was also not, something that was just objectively mocking anyone who decides that they feel they should go to church. And so if only for that reason alone, I think it's worth supporting, the company for what they're doing. Also, it was just very nice. It was a nice, piece of modern music.
Matt's also written a longer review for us on the website, www.fqxi.org/community. And if you missed the performance of The Astronaut's Tale, don't worry. Encompass plans to stage it in full in the fall, and they also plan to revive The Theory of Everything. We'll keep you updated on that.
That's all we have time for in this edition, but please contact us if you have ideas for topics that we should include in the future. You can email us at podcast@fqxi.org or tweet us at FQXI. If you happen to see The Astronaut's Tale, tell us what you thought.
We'd also like to hear if you have any burning questions you'd like to put to a professional physicist, and we'll ask some of our members for responses. No question is too small.
Though some questions might be too big. Please don't ask how to combine quantum mechanics with general relativity, for instance. Thanks again to Jeff Tollickson, Frank Wilczek, Nancy Rhodes, and Matt Roberts. There's more information about all that's been discussed on our site, www.fqxi.org/community.
She's been Zia Morali.
And he's been Brendan Foster.